Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economicology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Humorist, journalist, and author Roy Blunt Jr. has written over 24 books, as well as many articles for various periodicals. He's also a frequent panelist on National Public Radio's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me program. Roy's most recent book is Save Room for Pie, Food Songs and Chewy Ruminations. Roy visited Traverse City in 2011 and talked with me on the stage of the City Opera House. At that time, Roy's book, Alphabetter Juice, had recently been released. Roy started off telling me about the time he reported for Esquire on some of country music's biggest female stars.
I was there in the Grand Ole Opry, and Dolly Parton was about to go on, and somebody pulled me aside and said, "Watch the bulbs." And I thought there was some kind of rude reference to her chest, but when she walked out on the stage, a million flash bulbs went off in the... I noticed that did not happen when I walked out on the stage. Maybe next time. I don't like to drop a hint, but yeah.
Right. You've done so much. I mean, I'm reading here, you've appeared in maybe 168 different periodicals, from The New Yorker, Gourmet, Vanity Fair, GQ, TV Guide, Organic Gardening, The Norton Book of Light Verse, The Ultimate Baseball Book, Classic Southern Humor, Sudden Fiction, and The Elvis Reader.
The Elvis Reader, yeah. I saw Elvis in the coffin.
You did?
Yeah. When he died, I was in Nashville, and my friend Slick Lawson, who's a photographer, and I just went immediately to Memphis, and we got there the night before the funeral and went to the mansion and talked to the guard there at the gatehouse. And I actually stole what would have been Elvis's last evening paper, the Press Senator. It's hard. Slick is dead now, and it's hard to authenticate it, but I have it still. It just looks like any copy of the Press Senator, but it's I have it.
That's funny.
It wasn't funny at the time. I mean, Elvis was dead. Jeez. But
do you think you're funny? I mean. We call you a humorist. You're not. You've written one novel, First Hubby.
Well, there's nothing less funny than talking about being funny. But I wrote a book called Be Sweet about, because people are always asking me, what makes you think you're funny? How did you get funny? And so I wrote a book about growing up and the influences that may have contributed to that. Some of them positive, others of them not so positive. My mother had a really hard childhood. She was abused and treated terribly. We never found out all the details, but she was an orphan, and she would do things like, I would have a friend over when I was a little kid, and she would say, we were about to have lunch, and she would say, "Now in this house, we don't allow the children to eat indoors. You will have to eat out on the step." And I could never. But in fact, I mean, she was probably seriously treated, or felt like she was treated like that as a child, and she was sort of taking it out. And then, well, another thing. It's terrible. My sister was going to go off to Germany with somebody she was not married to. And my mother just gave her such a hard time that I actually flew down to our house from New York, my little sister, to help my little sister out. Of course, I made things much worse. But at one point, my mother said, "You have ripped out my heart and stomped on it on the kitchen floor." And the only thing I could think to do with that as a heritage is to push it a little further. I mean, if my mother had said, "You have ripped out my heart and stomped on it on the kitchen floor," that I just finished waxing, then it's funny. And I think, I don't want to dwell on it too much, but I think that a lot of it comes from that.
We were talking earlier about you stepped on a hamster once. We have some hamster lovers in the audience.
No, I didn't do it. I didn't stomp on a hamster.
No, that's right.
I was talking about the book, in this book, Alphabet of Juice, about the word squelch. Now, my argument is, first of all, this book and my previous book about the alphabet are partly written out of outrage against the linguistic notion that the connection between words and the sounds of words and their meaning is arbitrary. That's something that linguistics wants to establish so that they don't have to think about the actual messiness and funkiness and juiciness of words, and they can get off into notions of universal grammar and things like that. Okay, so I argue against that right about this. But one thing that linguists will admit is that there's such a thing as onomatopoeia, obvious words like, snap, crackle, and pop. Okay, there are those words. But otherwise, but take a word.
It sounds like the thing is.
Yeah, just obvious, yeah. Obvious imitation of the sound. But there are words like squelch, which you look in the Oxford English Dictionary, it will say it's imitative. And onomatopoeic. But onomatopoeic is just about sound. And in fact, I suggested that you step on a grape or step on anything, and it doesn't make the sound squelch. It's just somehow the word squelch recapitulates the activity of squelching, because it presses the tongue up against the roof of the mouth, and it makes a sound that is what stepping on something would sound like if you could. In fact, when you step on, I urge people to do this, step on a grape sometime and try to spell it. You just can't spell it. It's more like poop or something. See, that's a terrible joke. But I did once step on a hamster accidentally. Her name was Ann. And she was owned by a guy named Larry Banks, who was in my dorm, and she kept getting out. And I woke up one morning and got out of bed and stepped on Ann, and it didn't, and I squelched her, but it didn't make the. It made a terrible sound, sort of a pop, that I hear still, and I wish I could forget. And I'm sorry that I should never have written about it, but there it is.
You have a word for this that you've coined with the last book.
Oh, yes.
Sonicky.
Sonicky, because sonicky. Or the Greek term, the more scientific term, is kinephonic. It combines the sound element and also the kinesthetic or kinetic element. And the kinetic element is how it moves through your mouth, how a word moves through your, for instance, the word through. The word through goes straight through your mouth.
Right.
Whereas the word thwart.
Comes back.
Yeah, it goes, starts out, goes through the wart. And the word throttle gets back into your glottis. You know, it's like it gets very close to a glottal stop, which is like, oh, no, you didn't. So those things are not accidental, I think. You can't decode every word according to the sound and according to how it moves through the oral apparatus. But many words are made, rendered more expressive and more meaningful by the way they operate in your mouth.
And you started that in Alphabet Juice, which was in 2009, your first book. And Alpha Better Juice is the sequel, right, to be followed by Alpha.
If we all join together and pray, then maybe Alphabet Juice will come
Alphabet
about. But I don't want to rush into Alphabet Juice, because where do I go from that? I would be happy to write alphabet books for the rest of my life.
Tell why? What
I love
that?
Writing about words. I always wanted to write about words. Literally have collected notes about words since high school. I have all these old notebooks and things, some of which I have lost, and I keep trying to dig them out. But at any rate, I've always loved words. My mother, that same mother, taught me to read phonetically and to sound out the words. And she also taught me to read by reading to me from Uncle Remus stories. Now, there are also reasons to about Uncle Remus. We'll talk about Uncle Remus stories, but the dialect in those stories is wonderfully captured in letters. You know, to be show, T-O-O-B-Y-S-H-O. It's to be sure, but it's spelled to be show. And by and by, B-I-M-E-B-Y is by and by. But it captures, and it just thrilled me to think, partly because I grew up Southern, and I was aware that people on TV spoke a little differently from, well, I did, you know, and lots of writers have, lots of humorists in particular maybe, have sprung from first generation people who are trying to figure out English and compare it to the language they were raised with. So it makes them, you know, humorists like S.J. Perlman and lots of first generation Jewish writers who have, Philip Roth is the second generation, third generation, whatever it is, tend to be more fascinated with the English language, or fascinated with English languages in ways that, say, people who have grown up in Connecticut for 48 generations or not, because they came into the language from an odd angle, and they compare the way they pronounce things to the way the standard pronunciation. So that's part of my, and I've lost track of what I was talking about. But at any rate, but I've always loved the idea that you could spell things phonetically and spell things differently from the dictionary, but at the same time, I love dictionaries. So Mark Twain created the standard narrative American narrative template. Ernest Hemingway, a Midwesterner, said that all of modern American literature begins with a book by Mr. Mark Twain called Huckleberry Finn. And the reason for that is that Mark Twain, the reason he said that is that Mark Twain combined formal English with American vernacular in this smooth mix that tells American stories. And that's and that involves a lot of sonicky.
Sonicky. In 2002, you did a documentary with PBS called Mainstream.
Yeah.
Right, and you wrote something that I thought was fascinating. I thought we might want to hear that. It's about your journey down the Mississippi. Since I was a teenager, Roy wrote, I had been holding forth about American food and music and politics and heroes in newspapers, magazines, and books on radio and television at universities and conventions. He really is busy. I had driven across the country, visited 48 of the 50 states, played baseball in Yankee Stadium, reported on the civil rights movement, spent a year with the Pittsburgh Steelers, interviewed Ray Charles and Martin Luther King and Billy Carter and Loretta Lynn and Willie Mays and Reggie Jackson, watched Ku Klux Klansmen burn a cross, mocked real presidents and created a fictional one, served in the U.S. Army, gotten a degree from Harvard, sung badly on stage with Bruce Springsteen and Stephen King and Dave Barry, and then you had time to sire two vigorously American children, dated a TV star, I wonder who that was, been married to a Texan and a Massachusettsian, which I didn't know was a word, swapped quips with Johnny Carson, and written the screenplay of a movie in which Bill Murray takes an elephant from Missouri to California. But I still felt that there was a lot I had to learn about America. You did all that stuff.
Yeah, I did all that stuff, yeah. I haven't done anything since I wrote that. Oh, I had to get it all in while I was young.
And that was during your you were a Sports Illustrated reporter from 68 to 75.
Right.
And then you became a freelancer. So I imagine a lot of those 106 periodicals that you appeared in, these stories were those kinds of...
I was a freelance writer. I still am a freelance writer and managed to get away with it for a long time. And, you know, the thing is that if you call up a publication and say, I would like to go down the Amazon and write a story, they will say, well, so would we, you know. But if they call you up and say, we need somebody to go down the Amazon, they say, oh, yeah, I'll do it. And so I was juggling a lot of things at the same time. But the thing going down the Mississippi River was a PBS special. In a lot of ways, I did not enjoy it because I was going with a TV crew. And the TV crew, the idea was I thought the TV crew was going to follow me down the Mississippi River. If you've ever been, you have been with a TV crew, I'm sure. It meant I was following the TV, you know, the TV. and I couldn't stop to talk to anybody at any length. It wasn't the way I liked to report. I've always liked to just sit around with people and gradually get to know them and try to get to the point where they forget that you're a reporter and not to squeeze stuff out of them, you know, but to, you know, talk to them in a natural way. And we didn't get enough of that done. But they had found all kinds of characters down the river and we, and, you know, got in the water and we used all the different conveyances and, the title of the thing was The Mainstream, and I asked people all down the river, all along the river, what they thought mainstream America meant to them. And I found that the more mainstream you were, the more you never even heard of that Mm-hmm. You know, the mainstream America is this journalistic thing or political thing. People don't know. I don't know. I guess I'd say, well, mainstream would be, well, plumbers, I think, are mainstream. And then because he's a plumber, you know. So it was nice to see how uncategorical everybody was.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, more of Doug Stanton's conversation with Roy Blunt, Jr.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to my conversation with humorist Roy Blunt, Jr.
Given you've done so much and traveled so much, if a spaceship landed from Mars right now and the people got off, I mean, what would you, and how would you describe America to them? I mean, since you've seen so much of it, right, today?
Well, I think they would probably... It would be interesting to me to find out. I would more likely want to ask them what their impressions were. I don't know. And mm-hmm. I would learn more by asking them. That's my inclination, is to ask people questions instead of, mm-hmm. you know, Tell that's me. The thing about when you become an author, you tend to go around talking about your book that you've already written. You don't learn anything that way. I miss going out and mingling with people. Mm-hmm. And it would be very interesting to mingle with space people as long as there were no anal probes involved.
You've got some great funny titles. That first book about the Steelers in 1974, about three bricks shy of a load. In 1982, One Fell Swoop, or I'm Just a Bug on the Windshield of Life. And then the funniest one, I think, and the most curious is 1991, Camels Are Easy, Comedy's Hard.
Ah, yeah. There's a picture of me on a camel. I did a camel safari through Kenya. Or through part of Kenya, and so I wrote a, you know, I had a column at that. I have had columns with God knows how many magazines, and one of those magazines was Condé Nast Traveler, and I wrote a column about being on a camel safari. My girlfriend at the time was a BBC person, and she knew Africa. She had been an African correspondent for the BBC. So we went to Africa, went to Uganda, and had a wonderful time. And but we went down, we went off into the northern counties, whatever you call it. That's Ireland, isn't it? On camels, and they were great. They, you know, the old camel cigarette theme: "How mild, how mild, how mild can the..." That's the rhythm of a camel. It's amazing. I don't know whether it was based on that or not, but. Camels have this great, you think of camels as an awful animal to ride, but they have this smooth lope. So it was great to ride a camel. And these camels each camel had a Maasai warrior to keep it from biting my head off, but which camels will apparently do if they're in heat, and these weren't. But they also, they made this wonderful noise. I actually blew out the entire upper register of my vocal apparatus by imitating camels getting up in the morning, and it was like it's the first time the camel ever heard that they were a beast of burden. They say, "What?" You know, because they started. I can't do the upper part. It started out, every morning, like, "What the?"
Now you could spell that, maybe.
Yeah, well, I did in this book. I do. I actually bring that up in this book and. Spell it, but I point out that spelling can't quite do justice to it. There are too many G's. It's hard to get it. But
Alphabet or Juice has some words we were talking about before we came on that basically, why this is a terrific book is any of you who listens to Words to the Wise on our local radio. Michael Sheehan is a...
We had dinner with
great,
tonight.
Yeah, great host of that show. It's hugely popular. If you have students or if you just like to read, because what Roy does is, let's take an example of, say, ad hominy. I mean, tell us, what was the process of creating this book?
Well, Ad Hominem is just a little ethnic defense thing on my part, that an ad hominem argument is assuming that something is dumb just because it's been said by a Southerner. That's ad hominem. So there are all kinds of different... A book like this is just a great excuse to say all kinds of things involving words, and that's
Do you have a favorite in here? We went through... you've got something going on with... I wrote, though.
I think of an example, but more and more I find people using a sort of lazy though, where it should be a but. Now, can I think of an example? Maybe I can read one, an example from here. The lazy though. Here's an example. The president has repeatedly challenged Washington media culture's focus on short-term results, though it remains unclear whether he will succeed.
Should be but, right?
But, yeah, right. Well, though. You know, and it keeps you from having to commit to exactly what you mean. It just sort of tacks on the though. And lots of times people use conjunctions where they should just stop the sentence and start another sentence. It's a kind of journalistic convention that is irritating to me. I like short, when there's nothing wrong with a short, choppy sentence if there's no point to just tack on an and. And people don't want to use but anymore. It's like but, yet is the new but. Because we need to hold on to yet. Yet means nevertheless. Yet is stronger than but. But people will just toss in the yet because they don't want to say but for some reason. Somebody told me that their English teacher told them that you shouldn't use but because it's a negative word. Yeah, it's supposed to be
really?
A negative word. Yeah, and it sounds like a negative. It stops you, but... It's a difference between and. I wrote about and in here. And sort of keeps you rolling, but stops you a little bit, and that's mm-hmm. what it's supposed to be. Whereas yet is a little softer, sounds softer, but yet should be stronger than but. I argue with newspapers quite a bit.
Yeah, I can see that. When you write these books, are you sitting in your office having this conversation with yourself or with your wife?
I used to be until I started writing these books. Oh. I think I told you at dinner that I complained recently directly to the New York Times because I pay for the New York Times online now, and I think everybody should because it's cheaper. And you shouldn't try to get it for free. I've been getting it for free for a long time. It's $2-$3 a month or something. It's great. Or a week, whatever it is. At any rate, it's worth it. It's a great newspaper, and it shouldn't die. But I also found that you can get Doonesbury from the New York Times online. I love Doonesbury. And that's the only reason I buy other newspapers sometimes is to get, when I'm somewhere else, I got to get Doonesbury. But it's now in the New York Times online. But when you go to the cartoon thing on the New York Times online, it also has the crossword section on that same page. And there are these offerings where you can buy crosswords, special crossword deals. And one of the crossword deals is the classic crossword challenge. It says classic crossword challenge, : challenge your friends or yourself to compete with you somehow or another in completing the classic crossword. But it doesn't say challenge. It says Changel, yeah. Changelle. You can look it up. It says classic crossword challenge, : changel your friend. I mean, it's such a strike, and the two words are right next to each other. So I just thought, I figured, well, they made a little mistake. So I just, and you could ask questions. So I sent in sort of this jocular thing. I said, what's a changel? And the answer came back, really kind of concerned sort of answer, saying, well, we can't answer your question. We don't know what you're asking. So then I quoted the whole thing. I just quoted, and I sent that in. And with a question mark at the end. And they still said, we can't respond to your... So finally I said, it says in your crossword thing that it says challenge Changel. Is Changel a new... Because I thought it might be a new kind of puzzle, Changel. In fact, I Googled the word Changel, and it came up in various comments. I think it was also a typo. I said, or is it a typo? And finally I got back a response, said, thank you for finding a typo in our crossword thing. But But they still haven't fixed it. That was over a week ago. Check it out. Challenge Jangel. If that had been me, I'd have done, oh, God, I got to fix that right away. But if it were in my book, Jangel for Challenge, I'd be mortified. But,
is Alphabet or Juice an allusion to the Marx Brothers and Alphabet Soup? And I know you have a great fondness
duck soup,
for...
Yeah, right.
I mean, Duck Soup. Yeah.
Actually, I wrote a... No.
No, that's... It's okay. Not.
But I did write a book about Duck Soup in between Alphabet Juice and Alphabet Juice. I think a lot of my books may have... I wrote a book called One Fell Soup and another one called Soup Songs. In fact, soup pops up a lot in my book. But, yeah, I wrote a book about Duck Soup called Presenting the Marx Brothers in Duck Soup, the greatest war movie ever made.
Right.
And it's I love that movie because it's just... You know, it's full of puns and things, so linguistically it's great, but it's also wonderful. The physical comedy involved, just wonderful. And it has no redeeming virtues at all. It makes no sense. It has no serious purpose. It just makes fun of everything and not in favor of anything. And it just constantly moves. Its only logic is just moving.
Right.
And the Marx Brothers move wonderfully together. And there's a great mirror scene between Harpo pretending to be Groucho in the mirror. It's two brothers who didn't like each other, but who grew up together and who been on the stage forever together, imitating each other. And it's just a marvelous dance. It's a wonderful. I could watch it over and over and over. And also I was able, incidentally, to achieve a pun in that book of my own, which was... last night I was in Philadelphia and somebody, a question from the audience was, my teenage son hates the word moist. And I said, well, I didn't know whether that was, he needed counseling or anything. I kind of hate the word dry more than moist, but that's a whole different thing. At one point, Harpo he's plaguing the lemonade salesman and he has this squeegee thing that's a horn but also soaks up lemonade and he fills it full of lemonade and puts it in the bulb part in his pants and bumps up against Edgar Kennedy and squirts Edgar Kennedy in the face. And Edgar Kennedy finally gets tired of it and grabs the thing and turns it over and squirts it down into Harpo's pants. And Harpo walks along and I was able to say that Harpo was moist by his own petard.
Okay. You know, how do you write so much? It sounds like it's fun for you because you have fun thinking about this stuff. But I mean, to write, you know, you just told us you were on an African safari and wrote a book about it. Then you went down the Mississippi.
No, I just wrote an article about it. I didn't write a whole book about it.
Oh.
There's just, that was part of a collection.
Do you write quickly? Do you write?
If I have to, you know. I did a story about a man named who, down in Alabama, Clanton, Alabama, who, I don't know whether many years ago you ever saw bumper stickers that said, eat more possum. They were all around. But anyway, he was, he had this whole possum thing, and he had possum shows, and I wrote a thing about possums. And I said, is a possum smart? And he said, he is if he has to be. But he'd rather just mosey along. And that's true of me, too. But if I have a deadline, I have to get something done. I made a living, right? I wouldn't be sitting here with shoes on if I hadn't. And my children would be barefoot as well if I had not written all those books. But, I'm 69 years old. That's not and a lot of those books are small, short.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there are more prolific writers than I, but I didn't have a steady... I just was a freelance writer, and so did all sorts of different things and lots of them into books.
Who of your contemporaries do you like to read? I mean, fiction or nonfiction or?
Well, a lot of people. I have to stop and think. I mean, I have just been reading a Laura Lippman mystery novel on my iPad. Actually, first time I've read a book on an iPad. I like her books. I just started reading her mystery novels. I'm not a big reader of mystery novels in general, but Richard Ford, I've always read his books. Well, Charles Portis is a writer whom I love to talk about. He's a little older than I am, but he's just a wonderful comic writer of comic fiction.
He wrote True Grit,
wrote True Grit, and he also wrote his first novel was called Norwood, and he wrote one called Masters of Atlantis and another one called Dog of the South. He's a kind of cult favorite because he refuses to do things like this and refuses to go to be interviewed or anything. But he's down in Little Rock, and he and I are friends. We have a correspondence. But his novels are so funny because nobody, the last thing on anybody's mind in his books is being funny. They are all so straight-faced and so earnest and so grim. His second book, Dog of the South, which came after True Grit. True Grit was a big bestseller and everything. And I really think he decided he was embarrassed by having a bestseller. He tried to write something that would try to set himself the challenge of writing a book with a boring narrator. And the narrator of Dog of the South is boring, but it's wonderfully funny. He's just like he's trying not to be, even he's trying not to be funny, but the people can't help but be funny. And that's the great thing, is to achieve that kind of, like you're not forcing anything, you're not making mm-hmm. anything happen, but it's just there, it just bubbles up from, and that's what I live for, is trying to capture some of that, that's what I love to read, is stuff that you don't think, oh, I see what he or she is doing there, or they're sort of pushing in a little exposition there, but it's just happening, it's just bubbling up.
Mm-hmm.
And so whichever of my contemporaries pulls off some of that, I love it.
Well, I think, are noodling over the idea of a novel yourself, and you said earlier it wasn't completely familiar territory. I mean, you've done one already, but you have a thing about maybe not wanting to deceive people?
Or? Well, I wrote one novel, and it was very hard for me. My friend Dan Jenkins, who I worked with at Sports Illustrated many years ago, actually went on to write fiction, semi-tough, and various football books. But he said when he was a kid, a teenager, he and his friends all had fake names that they were going to use if they got picked up by the police. And his was going to be Bob Roberts. And sure enough, he got involved in some kind of mischief, and the police picked him up. And they said, "What's your name, boy?" And he said, "Bob Roberts." And they said, "What?" And he said, "Dan Jenkins." You know? And that's sort of the way I am when I'm writing fiction. I think, well, here's what happened. You know, I'm making that up. I like to make stuff up as long as everybody knows I'm making it up. But to try to... So it was hard for me to write a novel, just sort of... But I finally did pull one off, but it was really hard. I had to stay up all night and drink gin. I wrote it under the influence of gin, which I could not do anymore, I'm afraid. It was hard. I had to just sort of shake off my... And I literally don't like to get people in trouble. You can't write fiction if you don't want to get people. Wait a minute. Explain things to everybody so they don't have conflict. And that's the whole point of fiction, is to have conflict.
Do you want to? Can you talk about what you think you might be writing about in this
novel? No, somebody might steal it. Okay. I have an idea. It involves the rapture.
Ah.
You know, the rapture. Because I'm from the South, I have to explain things in the North, and somehow or another people think that the rapture, you know, the whole thing about the rapture, you get the... There are all these huge mega-selling novels about the belief that in the last days the Lord will bring all the saved people will be brought up to heaven, and somehow or another, oddly enough, they will be pulled up out of their clothes mm-hmm. and brought to sit at the right hand of the Almighty, and then they can look down and watch the rest of us being plagued by boils and ulcers and toads and buzzards or something. And so I had people ask me to explain that. And so I point out, for one thing, it's it doesn't seem to me very feasible. I mean, if you were the Almighty, would you want a whole lot of pious, naked people stretched out to your right? I mean, at least you'd be saying, some of y'all come over here on the other side. It doesn't mean anything. And they be saying, "No, it has been processed. I'm sorry, Your Holiness, but it's what's the word we use? Sorry, sir. But it's prophesied that we have to sit on the right. We're going to sit on the right." And meanwhile, there would be arguments breaking out all down there, you know, because there's factionalism or whatever. And they'd be looking down at the people being tormented, and they, you know, people would be saying, I don't think they're being tormented enough. The buzzards are eating the locusts down there. It just cancels out. I think they ought to be plagued by wildcats and things. And so they'd be, and they're all naked. So there would be, in fact, some of them lapsing back into sin and would have to be back on earth looking for their clothes, which, so that's a rapture. But and also, point out to people who don't want to believe that other people believe in the rapture that it's sort of like the story about the preacher who said to his congregation, I want everybody in the congregation who wants to go to heaven, stand up. And everybody stood up except one old man in the front row. And the preacher said, I said, everybody wants to go to heaven, stand up. And he still didn't stand up. And he said, Mr. Deadweiler, didn't you hear me? I said, everybody wants to go to heaven, stand up. And then Mr. Deadweiler looked around and said, oh, I'm sorry, I thought you were getting up a group to go now. I don't think anybody wants to be raptured right yet. You know? How did we get off into that?
I don't know.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Roy Blunt Jr. reads from his book, Alpha Better Juice.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to my conversation with Roy Blunt Jr.
People may not know that you've had a career as an actor of sorts too.
And I was sorts, yeah. Funny,
you know, let me read some of this to you. The movie 1993 movie Philadelphia, Party Goer. Yeah. My favorite though is 1988 Married to the Mob. You played the humane reporter.
Yeah.
And how do you play a humane reporter?
Yeah, it's an oxymoron. Yeah.
And how'd you get that job?
I knew Jonathan Demme, the director, and he often asks his friends to have little bit parts. Married to the Mob, I think, is a really nice movie. Michelle Pfeiffer, mm-hmm. and God, I can't think of the name of the actor, but at any rate, who played Tony somebody. And he was coming out of the courtroom, and my line was, how are the feds treating you, Tony? That was my line. And it's easy to miss unless you're really looking for it. But then I had a cameo in Tremé last season, too.
So. People know that show on HBO, Tremé? Yeah, great.
Yeah, it's a wonderful show. David Simon created The Wire, which is the best TV there ever was, I think. And my wife and I have gotten to know him and his wife, and so he asked me to be in it. It was good.
You wrote a long piece about oysters in a book called Feet to the Street, I think.
Feet on the Street, yeah, about New Orleans.
Rambles through New Orleans, and it seems like you've spent a lot of time in that city.
Yeah, I love New Orleans. I lived there when I was just out of college for one summer and worked for the Times-Picayune, and I've just always loved New Orleans. It was it's sort of sinful and musical and full of great food and full of characters, you know, and I spent a lot of time down there. And then somebody was starting a series of books about cities, various writers writing about cities, and I got dibs on New Orleans and went down there a lot. It was a great excuse to go to New Orleans and wrote a little book called Feet on the Street, Rambles Around New Orleans, which is out of print now, but because it was before Katrina. actually. So it came out, thank goodness, and lots of it was swept out into the Gulf by Katrina. But I've been back a lot since Katrina, and have a lot of good friends down there. I love New Orleans.
When you worked on that book, do you walk around with a notebook and a tape recorder and a camera, or how do you, what's your...
Not a tape recorder or a camera. I have, you know, I have this, here's my entire office right here, is this thing. I have this little, this is my calendar, and this is my address book, which is falling apart, and this is my notebook. I have a lot of little things.
Right.
And I take notes in this, but there are also, I have lots of, I've been keeping notes for a long time. I don't, never had a diary. Well, I've sporadically had, briefly had diaries, but they never lasted very long. But I have written, taken a lot of notes over the years, and lost a lot of them, and a lot of them are piled up, and I never transcribe them. But
will you sit down and type that notebook up, and then just, was it a computer file somewhere?
I do it now. I type it in a computer. I have a lot of notes about words that I've been working on the next word book, should there be one. Yeah, but I don't do it in any very systematic way. Unfortunately, but if I'm doing a story, I will take notes. I never liked working with a tape recorder, which is probably, I mean, you probably need to work with a tape recorder these days because of libel or something. I don't know. I mean, it used to be that there was a little looser about taking, you know, about getting every word exactly right. I never used a tape recorder because I did a few times, but I hated it because you have to transcribe the whole thing. That takes forever, and you have all this stuff that you don't need, that you're transcribing that too, because anyway, I much preferred working, and I used to have a great memory. I wrote a book about the Steelers, spent a year with the Pittsburgh Steelers, and wrote a book, and I remembered stuff drunk that I couldn't remember sober now. I had a great memory.
Tell us about that. You said you were all but athletically a part of the team.
Yeah,
how did that work?
I was assigned by Sports Illustrated. They called me down to the bar one day and said, we're looking for somebody to spend a season with a pro football team. There was a book come out in England about somebody spending a year with a soccer team, an English football team. And they thought it was a good book, and they wanted to do it. The editor, Andre Laguerre, and other editors who hung out at the bar. There's a bar called the Ho-Ho, where they all hung out. You know, I won't go into that. But
and this is in Pittsburgh, or...?
No, this is in New York, Sports Illustrated.
Okay.
The editors hung out at the Ho-Ho, had lunch at the Ho-Ho. And I went down the Ho-Ho, and I said, well, and I had just gotten divorced, and so I was single and available and could take off. And I did. And then it was right before the playoffs, the NFL playoffs of 1972. And right after that, when we were trying to decide what team to do, it was the Immaculate Reception. The Steelers beat the Oakland Raiders. And I had also written a book about the Rooneys, the family that still owns the Steelers. And they were a great, real family who grew up in the streets of Pittsburgh. And the old man, the patriarch of the family, Art Rooney, grew up within walking distance of the stadium. And he still lived in an old house that was now in the middle of a black neighborhood. And it was just really a great urban setting. And it was still, Pittsburgh still had a lot of characters. And, you know, it was a real town. And I also loved the Pirates. The Pittsburgh Pirates of the 70s were in some ways my favorite team because, you know, you'd go in their locker room and they would all be yelling at each other and fighting and headlocks on each other and playing jokes on each other and calling each other names. It was just wonderful, but all sort of in fun, you know. Anyway, I love the Pirates. I won't go into the Pirates. So I like Pittsburgh, and so I chose the Steelers. And they wanted me to do the Rams or the L.A. Rams or the Jets or somebody, some big city team, but I didn't. I thought the Steelers would somehow. And it was true that the Steelers had not been covered that much at that time, in 1973. So I just showed up in training camp, and the PR guy said to Ray Mansfield and Bruce Van Dyke, who are offensive linemen, you need to get in with the offensive linemen, and at least these offensive linemen. So they took me down to this place called the 19th Hole, where all the team drank after practice, and I just got to know everybody, just hung out, and they thought, and I didn't take any notes to speak of. I would go home at night and take some notes, but they just assumed that I was not going to write anything because I was going to. And I did not, some of them did not like what I wrote, but I didn't get anybody fired or divorced or arrested.
Did Did you work out with him? No.
A little bit. Yeah. No, I mean, I didn't try. I think it's A Day at the Circus, Marx Brothers movie, Groucho, Eve Arden walks on the ceiling, you know, she plays this acrobat and walks on the ceiling, and she says, why don't you try this? And he says, no, I haven't, he's a lawyer, Groucho's a lawyer. He says, no, I have an agreement with the house flies. they don't practice law and I don't walk on the ceiling. And that's pretty much I've caught a couple of passes from Terry Hanratty and I messed around a little bit, but I wasn't going to get out there and, you know, George Plimpton had done that for me.
Yeah, Paper Tiger, right, yeah.
Right.
Hey, Roy, do you have
Paper Line. Yeah.
Paper Line, yeah. Do you have a passage you might want to read before we go to questions here that's...
Okay, I think this is a pretty good one because it's just about a letter, the letter M. The letter M is a great letter. It, you know, the word mammal, the kind of animal we are, mammals, comes from mammary, the mammary gland. That's a distinctive aspect of the mammal. And the mammary gland comes from baby talk, from mama. And also, matter. The word matter comes from Latin mater, which also comes from mama. And it seemed to me, it's part of my whole thing about the sonic and kinesthetic meaningfulness of words, that M is a great example, because it's babies say mama, and they say mama, and we say mmm, and we say yum, and so on. At any rate, so M is a real, not just an abstract thing to me, it's really physical. It's to anybody. M is a physical thing. It doesn't, maybe doesn't look like it's supposed to. It ought to be humped, look more like breasts than it does, but the little M does. But at any rate, M is the first letter that Helen Keller, who was struck permanently deaf and blind at the age of 19 months, learned to pronounce. She was 10 years old and had been mute. Her principal teacher and eventual life's companion, Annie Sullivan, had connected her to language and the world by spelling things out in her palm with fingertips 3 years before. But Helen remained incapable of oral speech until another teacher, Sarah Fuller, quote, passed my hand lightly over her face, as Keller would recall, and let me feel the position of her tongue and lips when she made a sound. I was eager to imitate every motion, and in an hour I had learned 6 elements of speech. M-P-A-S-T-I. Just imagine suddenly at the age of 10 figuring that out. What a great breakthrough. 4 years later, when she was 14, she and Mark Twain began a long and highly conversant friendship. Quote, he made me laugh and feel thoroughly happy, she wrote, by telling some good stories which I read from his lips. She would put her forefinger to his lips, her thumb to his throat, and her middle finger to his nose. His voice was truly wonderful. To my touch, it was deep, resonant. He had the power of modulating it so as to suggest the most delicate shades of meaning. And he spoke so deliberately that I could get almost every word with my fingers. In all, she wrote 12 books. Twain called her and Napoleon the two most remarkable people of the 19th century. I suppose there is nothing like our friendship in heaven, he wrote to her, and not likely to be until we get there and show off. I often think of it with longing and how they'll say, there they come, sit down in front. I am practicing with a tin halo. You do the same.
Thank you. Well, if we bring up some house lights a bit here, we can have some questions. We have microphones in the audience.
I was just wondering what, you mentioned contemporary writers. What, as a young man, what books do you remember reading, like sort of as a teenager growing up, what were meaningful to you?
As a teenager, I had a great 10th grade English teacher who I had been planning to be a three-sport immortal, but it was not working out at all. And so I didn't really have a career plan, but I would write things in class, sort of perversely. I was supposed to write about what I did last summer, and I would write about the pencil instead. So my English teacher was taken by that. Ann Lewis was her name, and we stayed in touch over the years. She died last year. She was a young teacher then. I was 15 and she was probably 23 or something. And she suggested that I might want to be a writer. And she was an advisor to the school paper. So she said, why don't you write for the school paper? And that had never occurred to me to write for the school paper. So I did, started writing for the school paper, and started making fun of people more popular than myself. And it felt good to me. But also, she gave me to read. She had all these old stacks of, probably the only copies of New Yorker, of the New Yorker in Decatur, Georgia. Literally, only stacked that high of copies of the New Yorker in Decatur, Georgia at that time. Decatur, Georgia is much hipper now than it used to be. But she gave me all those New Yorkers, and she also introduced me to humorous S.J. Perlman, James Thurber, Robert Benchley, S.J. Perlman, E.B. White, A.J. Liebling, all these great New Yorker writers. And I just suddenly loved the idea of moving to New York and writing funny stuff. It seemed to be a perfectly obvious course to take. It took me a lot longer than I expected, but had to do a lot of other things along the way. But those writers were extremely influential to me. But I wrote for the New Yorker some, but the New Yorker is not as oral a magazine as the New Yorker, in fact, one fiction editor of the New Yorker was quoted as saying, we deal in visual writing rather than oral writing. And I've always liked to try to capture the sound of things and to capture the sound of voices. The whole New Yorker humor tradition, it's a great magazine now again, has always been, almost always been a great magazine, but it had, those humorists like Thurber and basically tended to write about being afraid of what's in the drawer of their desk, there tend to be more about neuroses, where Southern humorists, many of whom are deplorable, but many of whom are wonderful, write about slavery and bears getting you, and that gravitated more back in the direction of more political and more visceral sorts of humor.
Please give a big round of applause for Roy Blunt, Jr.
That was Roy Blunt, Jr. talking with Doug Stanton. Roy Blunt, Jr.'s latest book is Save Room for Pie, Food Songs and Chewy Ruminations. Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economic ecology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.